This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a radio show and podcast about great trash and difficult art. My name is Hugh, I am the host of the show, and I'd just like to take this opportunity to put in a really mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on the show are reserved just because the thing that we're talking about is in some way not good. However, sometimes we're talking about aspects of art or artists that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode description for more details, and do be aware of your listening environment.
You are listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast about great trash and difficult art. Kia ora, good evening. I am joined this evening by Whai Tua Warbrick. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about a movie that I really had not had any cause to watch again since my children were very small. So thank you for that. I understand that you have like dedications you want to start with, which is like, this is a level of formality that I appreciate that I don't usually get.
No, that's very fair. Kia ora, everyone. I'm Whai Tua. I am a guy you've heard of now if you have watched one other show on this fine radio network. I do poetry. I do writing, I do university, and right now I am doing dedications that may come to bite me in the arts in the future. So this episode is I dedicate to one, Kendiz. This is a person in high school that I've somewhat regularly kept in touch with. We explicitly bonded over this movie because we were so fucking weird. Can we swear on this, by the way?
Absolutely.
Okay, go so fucking life. It's just a fucking weird movie that I loved and she liked enough. And secondly, I would also like to dedicate this episode to friend of the show, wonderful man who I've met and has gotten me in and around the art scene here in Palmerston North, writer, director, thespian extraordinaire, Cam Dickinson, who fucking hates this movie for some reason, and is part of the reason why I brought this here today.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, this is we're talking about the film The Polar Express from 2004, which I think can be charitably described as a Tom Hanks vanity project, because Tom Hanks is
six people in this movie.
A number of whom have extended conversations with one another. So a lot of this movie is Tom Hanks talking to himself in a variety of different voices that he's putting on.
It's so funny. I mean, that's the main thing that I bonded with Ken is about. We're on a long distance Zoom style psychology class before Zoom was really popular, before the Pandini. I mentioned The Polar Express, and we eventually came up and we started emailing about that, mostly with that as the contact point. And we ended up with the thing of, Hobo Hanks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tom Hanks is so many people in that movie. It's fucking wild.
It's completely insane.
Yeah.
It is incredibly divisive, right? I remember it being critically panned, but also if you go and look it up, there are a reasonable number of 4- and 5-star reviews out there of it.
Yeah.
So clearly it hits for some people really hard. Mm-hmm. How did you discover this movie? Like, were you the right age for it to be like a kid's movie when you were a kid? Like a new kid's movie when you were a kid? Or
So this movie came out in 2004 and I came out in 2002. So I grew up in the same age bracket where when I started to get opinions about stuff like favorite toys, the train movie was really good for the kid who liked trains.
Yes, right. I can see that. Because when we had the kind of initial conversation about, like, what is it that appeals to you about this, you said, I really like The Train.
Yes.
And this is a movie for a train guy.
Yes.
Absolutely.
This is a movie for a train guy. I just hope not to be the train kid in this movie because he's insufferable. No, my favorite character of the Polar Express, the movie, is the Polar Express, the train. It's so cool. I love that. They somehow managed to give a train a lot of character.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I hadn't made the connection because I don't think I'd watched as broad a collection of their movies at the time as when I rewatched it this time around. But my 14-year-old was sitting on the end of the couch, like on her phone, kind of half watching the movie along with
me. Oh, no, you watched it with your children?
Well, not on purpose. She was just hanging out in the lounge while I was watching it.
That's allowed. That's allowed.
I did when they were like children, because as we were saying before we started recording, when you have kids, you tend to just watch like
– you watch anything.
Everything.
Yeah.
And you maybe exercise a bit of curation to try and keep out the real garbage. But like,
yeah.
I could do a treatise on the development of the Barbie movies, man.
Movies are so good.
Well, that's the thing. Their range of quality is so vast.
Yes.
From
oh God, it's so
truly
huge.
Execrable to like surprisingly good. They have some wild 3D animation.
Oh.
Again, ranging from like seriously
trash,
unsettlingly bad to like, you know, not quite Pixar, but like getting quite.
Yeah.
And then by the end of the original run, they're doing really weird shit, like having Warriors references.
Like right.
In the, there's, oh, it's like the digital internet one where Barbie.
Oh, I've not seen that
in.
One. Oh, God.
Look, you're not really missing out, be honest.
Am I missing? I want to be missing out on the Barbie franchise.
Right at the end of that one, there's a bit where one of the baddies, I can't even remember what they are, they're some sort of digital goblin thingy, puts the bottles on its fingers and does the like Warriors come out to play bit, which
holy
is
shit.
A reference that no person in the TUG audience for a Barbie movie could possibly understand.
No, absolutely not. It's very much a hi, adults. We know you're here.
Yeah.
Have that. Have some of them.
Anyway, the point of this digression was that where I ended up with this movie is it's almost like you described a Studio Ghibli movie to a space alien.
Oh, my God.
And then got them to try and recreate it without ever actually watching one in the first place.
Oh, my God.
Like, it's got all of this stuff about, like, the focus on the machines. You
yeah.
know how Miyazaki is fascinated with, like, planes and, like, industrial buildings and stuff.
My favorite character in Howl's Moving Castle is Howl's Moving Castle.
Yeah, absolutely. And in Spirited Away, like the bathhouse with all of its like lifts and
just all of the intricate, deep intricacies of machinery or a system that is there to do something.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of that.
It's beautiful.
But the thing that consistently hits weird is the people, right?
Yeah, the people are odd. Not even at the visual standpoint, but the characters are. I mean, the kids' characters, but they're also like, God damn, Tom Hanks. God damn, all these elves. God damn.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And
it's a very Western movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it is spiritually elsewhere. It feels spiritually very much a container of like, I love that description of Ghibli, but you described it to a space alien who's never seen a Ghibli movie because it's true. Spiritually, it is a Ghibli movie. Logistically, it is a very Western movie about Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. So, are you familiar with the picture book?
I am familiar with the picture book. I did not own the picture book.
No, neither did I. Like,
no.
It's by a guy called, let me call up the tab so I don't get his name wrong, Chris Van Allsburg.
Yes.
So Chris Van Allsburg is a guy who, again, like, I recognize his name because I have kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've spent enough time in the kids section of the public library with those, like, big bins
picture
books that they have.
All just, like, here is the letter that they begin with.
Yeah.
Not actually alphabetized.
Yeah.
Go.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, how else would you do it for tiny children?
Tiny children don't care. Tiny children just want to bite things and eat.
Exactly.
Book.
But when yes. I looked him up, a thing kind of slotted into place for me. So one thing about Chris Van Allsburg is he's also the guy responsible for the book Jumanji that gives us Jumanji.
Oh, wait. He was the guy who made the book Jumanji that gave rise to the game Jumanji that gave rise to the movies Jumanji, Jumanji, Jumanji 2, Back into the Jungle?
Yeah. Although I don't – I think the game may be after the
– Original movie?
After the original movie. I think it goes like book, then they make the movie of the book, and then they make – the game of the movie, which is the movie of the book.
Oh, God.
But the second thing about him is he's got this really specific art style. He's one of these, like, kids illustrator, author-illustrator things. And he's got this really I've been struggling because I kind of, like, sat on my bed with a laptop while my kid was making dinner this evening and just looked at a bunch of his books. And they're all, like, really identifiably him. But it's hard to – it's like – it's almost photorealistic, but it's also kind of dreamlike.
Yes. If I'm remembering a picture of like the images of the book that I have seen, it is in that half state of watercolor-ish.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Or like pastel maybe.
Yes, pastel.
Like oil pastels, but it's – he's got a very sharp – kind of draftsman-like line, which means that all of his like landscapes and buildings and machines look very clean and quite realistic.
Yeah,
and he's got a similar approach to people, but he gets them a little bit off in a way that's just a touch cartoony, or maybe makes them look a little bit like models.
Well, it's a there's a principle in drawing where there's a general principle in art that you kind of have to I like the impressionist arts, and you have to sort of if you're trying to draw a mouth, you don't draw a mouth. You draw things that suggest a mouth so you get to the point. If you're trying to exactly draw a human being, it gets weird fast. Have you drawn the individual teeth in someone, the individual hair? It gets weird.
Yeah, no, exactly. You do. You have to make kind of suggestive gestures. And his way of doing that creates these often very still pictures. Even when you're depicting something that's kind of in motion, it feels kind of like you're looking at a model or a diorama or something. And I think part of what strikes a lot of people as uncanny about the movie is it's kind of simultaneously trying to be lifelike but also mimic his art style.
And that's where it gets hung up.
That's right. And so you end up with partly you've got the limitations of like 2004 CGI, which like completely computer-generated people now of days still look a wee bit uncanny.
They're still a bit odd.
Yeah. And in 2004, way
very
worse.
Odd.
And on top of that, a lot of the stuff that they're trying to copy is from this very, very draftsman-like, very still kind of surreal art style.
Yeah.
And it lends the movie a very strange atmosphere.
Yes, it is. There's a lot of moving in the movie. But yeah, I can see that now. That sort of stillness sort of pervades it.
Yeah,
in
absolutely.
A meaningful way. Where it's just like, okay, the train is moving and there's environmental effects that are moving, but it's a very still movie. You're moving everything around what's happening instead of the things in there are moving.
Yeah, and it's strange because I think your comment about it being a very Western production is on the money as well because, you know, there's this thing that they do in like every 3D animated movie of roughly the same period where there's always a sequence where people fall down a slide or something.
Yeah.
Like – it's like a little roller coaster moment.
Absolutely.
And this movie's got like three or four of them.
Yeah, it's got at least three. Yeah.
And I always felt like that was almost a tech demo shot. Like it was kind of showing off the capabilities of your 3D rendering rig.
Yeah. It's showing off. It's like how Spy Kids 3 was Spike is 3. You must wear the 3D glasses for anything to make sense, because otherwise, why all these effects? Why all these angles here?
Yeah.
You have to. It's an artifact of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And just like those combinations of flavors are an unusually strange brew.
Yeah, it's potent. It's a very potent movie, because whatever it's got, it has.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And like you can, like we just said, you can kind of feel the slightly detached stillness wanting to claw its way back through the wacky hijinks.
Yeah. It's so wacky in order to compensate for how very still it is. Because, okay, I'm gonna start talking about like a few scenes, because this is bringing something to mind. There is a hot chocolate scene, which I forget happened about 20 minutes into the movie.
Yes.
Because it's like, cool. Kid goes to bed, kid wakes up, kid sees train, kid gets on train, kid sits down, hot chocolate scene.
Yep.
And I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, the hot chocolate scene is one page in the book. You get one shot of mustachioed waiter, mm-hmm. and you visually decode that as like fancy restaurant.
Yes.
Like that's the visual language on display. Like, but in the movie,
it's so much.
You get a song and dance sequence with these terrifying
near faceless men,
yeah,
who are just being like, hello, we're going to perform acrobatics at you, trying to catch steaming hot chocolate that is gonna hit you if we don't get a bowl in front of it first.
And it's so fast, and they're so I don't know if it was a choice to make them sort of mechanistic, or if it was a limitation of the way that they had to stage it or something. But they come off as like highly coordinated, terrifying waiter robots.
Yes. They're being puppeted. They're exactly being like, cool, you have been commanded to do this dance every time we do this. So every year we do this dance in front of these kids. If a kid gets in the way, they'll get their head chopped off.
Yeah. That's what it looks like. Yeah. It looks like if one of the kids moves wrong, one of the waiters is going to kick their head off.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to get fucking struck.
And that can't have been the impression they were going for, right? It wasn't.
No.
And that's the thing that gives me like the Studio Ghibli by an Alien vibes, because Studio Ghibli will cheerfully terrify a child.
Yes.
But they will do that on purpose. They'll be like, and now you're going to watch your parents turn into photorealistic pigs.
Yes. Go.
and that's going to be the worst thing you have ever seen.
You will become terrified, and this will be a memory that you will gab forever.
But
we're going to make it better.
Yeah. And we've decided that this is going to be a bad time for you for the next 5 to 10 minutes.
Intentionally, have a good one, kid. But when you show the Polar Express to somebody, especially a child, and they have not prepared for it, you're getting confronted with ghosts that are inhabiting human bodies, it seems, trying to be people and failing. And it's fascinating. I love that part of this movie in a meaningful way, because I love seeing the artifice of it. I like seeing how this movie is very much of its time, very much of its place, very much a Christmas movie for kids, but it's also doing a bunch of buck wild stuff that you could sort of fit into the time, but you could also kind of not fit into the time. Like, it's doing enough that you're not just bored.
No, absolutely.
You're never bored during the Polar Express. You're always in rapture.
Yep, or possibly, like, bewildered.
Yes.
But yeah.
I like to put it as rapture, but, you know. Again, this is my choice for a reason. I like this movie a lot.
Speaking of ghosts, one of the other things that's not in the book is that the train has a resident ghost of a hobo.
I love the hobo so much.
I kind of love him. The hobo as well.
He's so good.
But he's such an odd tonal addition.
Yeah, I deeply love the hobo. Hobo is my second favorite character. There goes train and then the hobo. Because he is so purely against the spirit of Christmas, but he's also very – he's so very much a jaded, cynical, downtrodden adult who's hitchhiking on this magical train, which asks – which gives you a bunch of questions that you want to interrogate if you really wanted to every year, but has enough courtesy and enough pleasantry and enough social care or like a bedside manner to comfort a child.
And he intervenes to help them out as yes. well in sort of mysterious, almost like, almost like Christ-like, you know, one single footsteps.
Okay. Are we calling him Christ?
No, I'm not calling him Christ. but he does like sort of mysteriously intercede at various points in the movie.
Absolutely.
If you want to pull on like deep biblical are you familiar with the idea that Satan is a sort of an interpretation of an older figure?
Oh, so there's like somewhat?
There's a figure within some strains of Judaism who is sort of like Satan, but he's not a tempter and he's not a force of evil necessarily. He's like the lawyer for the prosecution.
Oh, like so from Devil's Advocate.
Kind of, in a way. It's like you present yourself to God and say, like, I'm a worthy person, I've lived a good life, and the role of this figure is to be like, yeah, but did you really?
Yeah.
And to give you opportunities where you might strike, but not necessarily in the sense of like a tempter or a corrupter in the way that the Christian devil is.
Gives you choice. It gives you choices from which to fall.
Yeah. Yeah. And the tramp's sort of like that kind of figure. Like he's not entirely antithetical to the Polar Express.
No.
And he seems to be bound to it.
Yeah. He seems like a entity that is in a way an antithesis to the Polar Express spiritually. Like if you were to be like, cool, there is this magical, wonderful train that takes kids to the North Pole for whatever reason to show them the spirit of Christmas, show them Santa Claus, there must be an evil. There must be something that is on the train to balance it out spiritually. And that's the hobo.
Yeah.
But he's also a decent being. He's not, he won't push kids off the train, he won't be a devil, but he'll be like, yeah, will you doubt Christmas? I'm here. I surreptitiously may or may not doubt Christmas. Are you going to fall?
He also plays the hurdy-gurdy.
Yes, he does. I saw that when he was just like coming out of the fog as our main character. Do you know what the name of the main character is?
No.
The name of the main character
is Hero Boy.
It's Hero Boy in the credits.
That's right.
Hero Boy, that's another reason why I love this movie. It's just Hero Boy, the main character, Billy. Mm-hmm. And I think Train Kid gets a name. Like the kid in the yellow gets a name. The girl in the pink, I hope she's not Hero Girl, but I'm presuming she's all
she
thing.
Might be. I don't think she has a name either.
No. 2004 really wasn't more good.
So my hot take about the hobo, though,
yes.
is that if you could go back in time and get the ear of Tom Hanks,
yes.
you should convince him to cast another Tom Waits. And otherwise keep the hobo is like the exactly entirely the same thing. Just have him talk like this.
They're like, oh. Like, damn, a biker was killed by this train and then stuck to the train spiritually.
But I mean, like, that's a fascinating concept. Yeah. Right? Why does this train have a ghost?
Yeah. Why does this train have a ghost who is – well, actually, this sort of come to me as we're talking. There is a certain type of American folklore of the trickster spirit, mm-hmm. of the rabbit in the briar patch. And be like, oh, don't trust me there. Don't let me go. Gone. Mm-hmm. And it's similar. I think it's a similar thing that's happening here, where it's a trick. Like, if the conductor, who is Tom Hanks, is a spirit of complete order and thing that like, we got to be there on time, we have to be there on time, insofar as being there at all is on time, because again, magical rules. There is also this other being, the hobo, who is. Sort of that very energetic, yeah, you can do anything. I ride on the top of the train. No one comes onto the top of the train. Where it's that tricksy, mischievous, poking at your insecurities part of the process being like, hey, what if it is all a dream? What if it is all bad? What you going to do? What you going to learn?
Yeah, this is a fascinating point.
Yes.
We will continue with it in a second, but we are almost at the halfway point, so we are going to take a quick break for station messages, and we'll be back right after this.
If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate. If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app.
You are listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast produced by Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu, with the support of New Zealand On Air. So cheers for that, guys. I am talking to Fai Tua Warbrick about the movie Polar Express. Now, we were talking about the hobo and the conductor as like entities. And I think like on one level that's correct, but also, I think the know-it-all kid gets done dirty by this movie. Because if you're in a movie about a mysterious train, you really want the train autist to be, like, helping you out.
Yes.
And I feel like he should have been part of, like, the core group more. As the guy who knows about trains a bit too much.
Mm-hmm.
That aside, he recognizes the train as a specific train.
Yes.
From the 1930s.
Yes.
Which... based on vaguely visually the period when the movie is set, makes it maybe 15, 20 years old-ish?
Yeah, I would think about it that the movie takes place in the 50s, 60s, of that vibe.
So, like, it's not that old of a train.
No.
Right? By the same logic, if you set the Polar Express now of days, the Polar Express would be a diesel electric.
Oh, no.
If you're thinking about, like, the
in
same
the same process,
sort of,
And
similarly, like, the conductor talks about how many years he's been on the run.
Yeah.
And it's not that, like, it's not an inhuman, it's like 30 years or something like that. Which also means that he's probably been on since they adopted that specific train.
Yeah.
So before that, presumably... there was a different train with a different conductor.
Yeah.
It's just they include details which they don't need to put in.
No.
Which open up all of these questions.
Yeah.
When you stop and think about them for half a second.
It really comes to that point of Okay, we're gonna. I really do like this line of questioning, and I also think it's very valuable to bring up in story. So I am a D&D nerd, and I like D&D stuff, and I watch a lot of Critical Role and watch a lot of D20, and I like both of their DMs, Matt Mercer and Brendan Lee Mulligan. And I think a major thing that I think one of the others said was there is a to create a good story. There must be a balance between logistics and theme to generate an interesting story because an adult only really asks the question why a few times unless they're very autistic like us. Hello. So Star Trek being like, cool, why – how do you power the starships? Dilithium.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just two lithium? Yes. Where is it from? The planets. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is the last episode that I did. I was talking about a science fiction movie from the 70s called Phase 4.
Oh, hell yeah.
It's fascinating watch.
It interesting.
The only movie by Saul Bass, otherwise known as the title sequence guy, made title sequences for so many movies. And also did a bunch of logo design for corporations and stuff.
Interesting.
You have definitely seen Saul Bass designs and just not known who did them. But one of the things we talked about in the course of that is it's about scientists who enter a sort of battle of wits with hyper-intelligent ants.
Oh,
and
God.
One of the things that the scientists use is this pesticide, which they just refer to as 100% yellow. But it's perfect.
I love that.
Because, that is absolutely the way that people talk about chemicals.
Yeah.
You could find a barrel marked 100% yellow in a factory and you would think nothing of it.
Yeah, you're like, ugh.
And
you get away
it's,
from it.
Sciencey enough.
Yes.
And also it doesn't really raise any questions because they never really get into, what the mechanism of it is or anything. When they deploy it, they literally spray, really vivid yellow paint out of nozzles around their high-tech facility.
Fascinating.
So it just makes, literally 100%
yellow
in a circle on the ground all around. Plenty of pesticides actually kind of look like that.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, in the course of making the Polar Express, they couldn't help but get too specific about some stuff.
Yes, they got hyper-specific about a certain few things that really begets questions. And I've specifically brought up I remember seeing this a while ago. I'm not going to read this out in this title because it's so long, but I would like to keep you open to the Reddit post on r/fantheories called An Insane Deep Dive into the Polar Express, What It Represents, What It Means, and the Christmas Conspiracy.
Right.
Having titles of basically discussing why the movie is this way from a perspective of what if we just try to answer all the questions in the movie in the same time? And it's basically being a line from it. The four most important Tom Hanks's in this movie are the older version of Hero Boy, the Conductor, the Hobo, and Santa Claus. And it's very much like a deep dive in why this movie's idea of belief, understanding magic, the logistics of magic, the reality of this being on the train, what it's all about. And it's very much it really does harken to the thing of this movie is a very speculative movie in a way that just somewhat undercuts the thing of Christmas because it just gives you so much weird stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think it's illustrative to go and read the picture book.
Yes.
Because everything that makes this movie strange is them attempting to fill a gap.
Ah.
The picture book is very, very limited detail, kind of fairy tale or mythic register.
Yes.
It is told from the first person perspective of the boy, but it's almost like he's describing a dream or something. And it's very like, I got up, I went out, the train was there, I got on the train. We sang songs, we had hot chocolate. The whole travel period that gets them to the North Pole after that is like, I think, four textless pages. So none of the business with like the train getting trapped on the lake or anything.
The best scene in the movie. The best scene in the movie is the fucking Tokyo drifting on that ice lake.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I love it. It's so good. It's so good. That doesn't happen. It just immediately should shatter under the weight of a full train if a bobby pin is the thing that breaks it. If your ice sheet breaks under the strain of one bobby pin getting a perfect strike into ice and not under the several hundred tons of metal, wood, and person that is currently careening over it, insofar it can get up to the point where you can have a very theatrical, very dramatic going back on the tracks and the sparks and everything without kids drowning. It's a good scene, though.
Yeah, it is.
It's dramatic.
It's very dramatic.
It's so good.
And, you know, speaking of kids drowning, like the the back passages of the carriages of the train are underwater for a while, which, like, that's not how trains are not designed to go under the water.
No, they're not watertight. No. If you get between a train and the track, you have no train anymore. Mm-hmm. That's how it goes. Water between train and track, you have no train anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Except the Polar Express does it because she's a badass. I love the Polar Express. She's awesome. She does this every year and she doesn't get tired. Love her.
I guess where I was going.
If you did
a straight adaptation of the picture book, you would end up with a very atmospheric and quiet, probably short movie. Like a half hour, maybe 20 minutes short.
You get a short film.
Yeah.
A Sundown short film.
And I mean, it might well be critically acclaimed, depending on how stylistic you were able to be with it.
No, it could be great.
But everything that makes this movie so weird is something that was inserted to make it into a feature-length, like, action-packed romp. And I find it fascinating that at every point they made the strangest decision possible about that. Sometimes they didn't make a strange decision. They made a normal decision that just feels weird in context. Like, incidentally, there are wolves in one of the images in the book. And so they have a wolf chase.
Yes, another one of my favorite scenes of the movie includes the wolf chase, which is basically when Hero Boy loses Hero Girl's ticket, and it just has a three minute chase sequence where you're viewing the ticket as it goes onto ground, gets picked up by wolves apparently, plummets off a cliff, gets eaten by a bird, given to a bird, gets eaten to another bird, spits it out, gets it back into the track, gets back in. And I'm like, that's really good and really, it's really beautiful in a way that is really at odds with 30 minute, like a minute or two beforehand, the hot chocolate scene.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right.
Yes.
Like, they cannot figure out if they're making, like, a sort of beautiful Rube Goldberg machine where you just watch complicated things happen in, like, a kind of domino sequence of events, or if they're making the kind of wacky movie where you clear cows off the track – no, reindeer off the track by, like, pulling on a guy's beard so that he honks like a reindeer.
Yeah. Or you have that series undertone that the hobo somehow brings of being like, are you a true believer in the spirit of this place? Oh, and then half a minute later, he goes, get on my back, kid. Otherwise, you're going to be half a person. There's a 1-inch clearance between this train, the top of this train, and the top of Flat Top Tunnel.
Yeah,
I love that. I love him so much. I love the hobo. But yeah, no, it's so many ideas. I don't want to say it's like like a studio meddling, but that's the closest that you can approximate to.
Well, I wonder if it's the opposite of studio meddling, right? Like, it's such a Tom Hanks bonanza. Yeah.
Yes.
I wonder if it is like Tom Hanks had a bunch of ideas, and because it was Tom Hanks's baby, where Tom Hanks talks to five other Tom Hankses for the majority
of the
movie.
Are you going to stop Tom Hanks and his gang of five other Tom Hanks?
Yeah.
No.
And
it's a family reunion. You're going to be between that.
And so maybe I haven't looked into the production of it, but maybe neither. Tom Hanks just got to do whatever he wanted.
Mm.
And maybe some of the suggestions were that like push things in a more sort of like action adventure comedy direction might be studio notes, but maybe that was something he was into as well.
Yes.
It's really hard to tell. And look, this is a test of my firm belief that if you are a really bankable star or director in Hollywood, they should let you do a weird one.
Yes. You should always be able to do a weird one. You should be able to do a weird one. That's how good things make, and that's how you get something that sticks into the mind of a poor young child when he has three movies that he watches over and over again, such as, look, man, the three movies that I watched over and over again because we had them were Polar Express, Shrek 2 on the VHS, and The Bee Movie.
Right.
I was a kid who watched The Bee Movie voluntarily multiple times a day.
Oh, speaking of like completely deranged animation decisions. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, like there is a Shrek connection as well.
Ooh.
In the sense that, have you read Shrek?
No, I've not read Shrek.
Okay.
I should read Shrek.
Shrek, the book, is completely insane.
Oh, God, I need to read Shrek.
The character of Shrek is just this completely loathsome monster that offends God himself. God tries to smite him with lightning, but Shrek is so powerful that he just eats the lightning.
I'm just imagining like a shitty drawing of Shrek and then the god from Monty Python and the Holy Grail just coming up being like, "Oi, you stink." And then Shrek doing his Shrek thing and goes, "I'm tired of you." Lightning, lightning, lightning at him.
Yeah, kind of. And there's no like the princess.
Is an ogre.
Well, she is, but she's got no other form.
Oh, it's so she's just her as an ogre.
Yeah, she's just like a similarly awful creature. And so he's like, "I've never seen something as ugly and vile as you. We should get married." And she's like, "Yeah, that sounds great." And the afterword is like they lived happily ever after scaring the socks off anyone unfortunate enough to cross their path or something like that.
That's really touching, really meaningful and touching. I also want to be someone who grows up to find someone who is, and I quote, a similarly awful creature. Because to have one, to be with a similarly awful creature is probably the best damn thing you can ever hope for in this world.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I've forgotten where I was going. Oh,
to the North Pole.
Yeah. I think the unusual thing, though,
yes,
right, is normally when I say you should get to do a weird one,
yes,
what I mean is John Borman made Deliverance. Deliverance is iconic. Everyone knows Dueling Banjos. Mm. Everyone knows Deliverance.
Mm.
Made a shit million dollars. Everyone very happy.
Yeah.
So John Borman gets to take all of that studio cred and make Zardoz, which is...
I don't know that.
Zardoz is a catastrophic failure.
Wait a second.
I love it.
Zardoz.
It is the movie where the image of Sean Connery wearing nothing but tiny orange trunks and orange thigh-high boots and
a Fu Manchu
moustache and ponytail comes from.
The weird big head.
Yes.
Okay.
The gun is good, the penis is evil. That's Zardoz.
I know I've seen the weird big head from, I think, Adventure Time.
Yeah,
probably. It's referenced, I think, a decent amount of Adventure Time, or at the very least, the weird big that head, who I do not know, looks like Abraham Lincoln, the King of Mars, spiritually, the same thing. It makes sense in context. It makes sense in context.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm like, wow, I think I need to watch Zardoz now.
Zardoz is long.
Yes.
Trips over its own feet a bit, but it's also incredibly earnest in its intensely 70s interrogation of what like masculinity is.
Oh.
And how it might be good, but it might also be destructive. But can you separate the good parts from the destructive parts? And what happens if you like have a society where you try and completely remove the destructive parts of masculinity? What does that do to people?
Oy vey.
Like, seriously, the gun is good, the penis is evil is like an iconic line. It is obviously very stupid, but the more you think about it, particularly considering it's the 70s,
like is reasonable for the 70s, because you know what else is happening in the 70s? The Vietnam War.
Absolutely. And it's coming
culture,
out
culture, sociology. All of the, like,
counterculture stuff. Absolutely.
I think, actually, amendment to my previous statement, I don't think it's from Adventure Time. I think it's from Rick and Morty.
Right. I could imagine Dan Harmon making Zardoz jokes.
Oh, yeah.
That would straightforwardly make. My point is.
Yes, continue.
That often when they make a weird one, that weird one is not for kids.
No, true. Yeah, no. It's like we've done the straight-laced, family-friendly, G-rated thing that has made a shit ton of money.
Well, and Tom Hanks, like, come 2004, he's been in Saving Private Ryan, right?
Saving Private Ryan. Forrest Gump, I presume,
He's become an enormously bankable movie star and America's favorite uncle.
Yeah.
But he's also done, like, R-rated, like, violent war movies and stuff. So his weird one didn't need to be for kids.
No, but then he. I pulled this up now because I wanted to. I've pulled up the production history. If we can go into a little, I'm just going to read from the Wikipedia article of the Polar Express. Tom Hanks optioned the film in 1999 after rereading the book to his kids with the hope of playing the conductor and Santa Claus. The book's author, Chris Van Allsburg, had been unwilling to sell the rights to the book for a film adaptation, but changed his mind after learning about Hanks' involvement. Castle Rock Entertainment subsequently made a seven-figure commitment to co-produce the film with Hanks' company Playtone, Van Allsburg, and William Tetler in March 2000, but then it could not happen. Then after it was postponed December after 2000, then it was picked up again in 2002 by Robert Zemeckis,
A man who never met a technical gimmick that he did not love.
Absolutely. Zemeckis and Broyles, like William Broyles Jr., new draft expanded the roles of minor characters such as the girl, know-it-all kid, and the lonely boy, and added the new character of Hobo. So the Scrooge puppet was inspired by Zemeckis, considering his childish choice, one of which was a puppet. After Zemeckis's Image Movers' contract with the DreamWorks Pictures ended, he made a new deal with Warner Brothers to fund, distribute, and provide studio space for the film. And then there's a bunch of other despite Van Allsburg's original terms, Zemeckis felt that a live-action version, it was apparently going to be live-action, was unfeasible, claiming, and I quote, "It would look awful, and it would be impossible." So they made it CGI. filmed on a black box stage with motion capture equipment. And that makes sense. It's basically, that makes sense of how that movie got to there. Getting chopped and changed. You have, like, people coming in, people coming out, people adding their new ideas, brought in the script. So what could have been the original idea from Van Allsburg and Hanks became Zemeckis' toying with it, and then eventually, through a bunch of other stuff, became the beloved, quote-unquote, but to me, truly, sincerely, beloved Polar Express.
I mean, I do want to talk about that experience of having three movies, right?
Yeah.
Like, so I'm somewhat older than you, and my mum was a no TV hippie when I was a little kid.
Yes.
We got a TV when we moved to Scotland when I was
wild,
like seven or eight ish, when we'd been in Scotland in a couple of years, because my dad wanted to do Open University.
Yeah.
And the way that works is that they transmit the lectures on a special TV channel at stupid o'clock in the morning. And you can like video them or stay up and watch them. There's just university lectures on the TV, or there was in the 80s.
That's cool.
But before that, we didn't have TV. Zoom. So like, but I absolutely like, my version would have been like video games on the Commodore 64. We had like one tape with five games on it.
Yeah.
And I played those five games in
over
rotation.
Over and over again.
And not to be like kids of today, but kids of today, right? Mm. Like if you have a Netflix sub.
You have an infinite amount
of
stuff. You
choose to watch the same three movies in rotation, but actually you can watch like their entire kids catalog. And it might be garbage.
Yeah.
But, you know, the three movies that you had also might be garbage, mm-hmm. and you just form this relationship with them because they're the three things you have.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, absolutely.
Similarly, when I was starting to develop independent music taste, the way that I got music was that I saved up my pocket monies, and I didn't have a job because I was lazy and disorganized. So it was just like whatever money I could scrounge up and be given.
So true, bestie.
And cassettes cost $20, $30.
Ooh.
That wiped me out for like months.
Oh boy.
And so I had two or three albums in rotation because
over and over again.
Those were the tapes I had.
Yeah.
And eventually I got wise to the fact that my friends had different albums and you could copy tapes for one another, and then my collection grew. But like still, you get this relationship with a piece of art because you are stuck with one or two things as a kid.
Exactly.
And you just have to go around and around and around on those.
You rotate it in your mind, and then you continue to rotate it in your mind and study it from all angles, even if that angle is train.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Look, this has been a lot of fun.
Yay.
I am glad, that I revisited this movie.
I'm glad you were too.
It is stranger in a more interesting way than I remembered.
Yes.
Like I remembered it being odd, but mostly what I remembered about it was that all of the people were kind of off-putting.
Yeah.
Going back into it as an adult and actually paying attention, it's just there are so many very strange decisions.
So many. The all the elves are male and they feel like they just walked out of like Brooklyn.
Yeah, no, they're all
like two steps away from being gnome mafia.
Yeah, no, they're mafia union guys.
They're mafia
they
union. They're absolutely mafia union guys, but like. The union guys for this most radiant being of Santa Claus, and they travel by pneumatic tubes, and they have so much infrastructure for trains here in the North Pole.
Which, according to the thing that they decided to make canon, which is left non-specific in the book, is only about 30 years old.
Yeah.
So it's all new.
It's all new.
Santa's just invested in this job.
Not now, elves. Santa is waiting for his dock in new boilers to go up. He is also in on that new coal's future. I have also heard of oil, but that will never happen.
It's so strange. Because, again, like, the elves are in the book.
Yes.
But they look much more just like that slightly childlike image of Santa's elves.
Yeah, like, it's like, da-da-da-da-da, like, we're little
illustration,
dudes.
Almost like illustrations of hobbits.
Yeah.
Like, that illustration style where they're trying to kind of fudge the difference between someone being child-sized but probably an
elf. Yeah.
But they don't have like that like weird craggy faced thing that the movie gives them.
No, these guys in the movies are very much men in their 40s with beer guts being like, yeah, man, another day, another dollar. Am I fucking right, dude? Except one of them also wears a tricorn, and also their voices are pitched three octaves higher.
It's and like there's a point where the lonely kid has to be coaxed to hand over a present.
Yeah.
Which is supposed to be like a heartwarming thing, but the elf that takes it off him sounds genuinely sinister.
Yeah, man. He's like, he's going to come around with his kneecaps, man.
Yeah. He's supposed to be like, don't worry, kid.
Don't worry, my child.
It'll come back on Christmas. It'll be fine. But he's like, don't worry about it, kid. I'll take that from you.
I'll take that. Hey. It's like, it's the hobo, but with a negative charisma.
Yeah.
They're all just lovable schlubs that are doing their job and are dealing with these kids who would just end up fucking everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Presumably every year as well.
Yeah. Yes.
Fascinating.
Extremely.
Fascinating. Deeply weird.
Mm-hmm.
We have come to the end of the show.
Yes.
If people like the Polar Express, or maybe don't like the Polar Express, but are strangely compelled by it, do you have other things that you would recommend that they check out?
Connected to the Polar Express. First of all, Thomas the Tank Engine.
Yes.
Any mm-hmm. of any of the railway series by Reverend, I think Audrey.
Yes,
Aubrey. Yeah. Love the railway series is great.
Mm-hmm.
You get Chuggington. It's great. I love that stuff. It's which also goes into the thing of the logistics of this mystical island that is in Sodor. There are so many things in the Thomas franchise that are unanswered, and it will always be unanswered, and it's very wild. So that's like trains and stuff. Mm-hmm. Weird movies that sort of alter my brain chemistry. I don't really know per se. I mean, you could get into specifically, oh no, that's a connection that I made when you made your Ghibli comment. Get into Ghibli movies and then get an obsession with train mechs. Like do Ghibli movies and then get into Lanza, but then make a train, Lanza being a role-playing game where you pilot a mech,
mm-hmm.
except you're a train. That's the best I've got at the moment.
Yeah.
Otherwise, other weird little like 2000s movies.
Mm-hmm.
They're so good.
My pitch would be there is a similar like weird mismatch of tones that's tickled my brain since I was a little child. And that is The Wind in the Willows. It's
Ooh.
Not connected in the sense of like mechanisms or adaptation weirdness.
Mm.
There are two things that bother me about The Wind in the Willows.
Yeah.
One is a lot of it is incredibly cozy.
Yes.
But there are these weird chapters where people get like infested with strange magic. Ooh. And it leaves them forever changed, and it's unearthly and kind of melancholy and completely tonally detached from the rest of the
Yikes.
Book, and it's very strange.
Okay.
And because the book's it's like designed to be read to kids, so it's incredibly episodic.
Yeah.
There are a couple of overarching plot threads, particularly towards the end of the book, but most of the time it's like there's a chapter and a thing happens, and then next chapter an unrelated thing happens.
Yes.
We're just watching episodes from the lives of these characters. But so like those unearthly things happen,
mm-hmm.
and then they don't relate to anything else.
Mm.
They just kind of interrupt the
like a little tableau, be like this, and then we continue on.
Yeah. Yeah, very strange. Yeah. The other thing that has the tone of the melancholy chapters in Wind in the Willows is like the Moomin books, but the Moomin books maintain that consistently, and Wind in the Willows just goes there and goes back.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about the Wind in the Willows that's bugged me since I was a kid is they never figure out the scale.
Mm.
They talk about how some of the animals are bigger than others.
Yeah.
They have animals talking to people.
Yeah.
They also have animals which are straightforwardly animals, like cart horses.
Yes.
But they still talk to them sometimes.
Yes.
And so the scale of, like, are the animals as big as people? Are people talking to animals that are the size of animals? Because they talk about how badger is bigger than rat and mole.
Yeah.
Like a badger is bigger than a rat and a mole.
But what does that mean?
Bugs me.
Mm.
However, that is...
Oh, one more thing. It reminded me, you just said mention the word mechanism. Just watch Robots. Watch the movie Robots. The movie Robots is so good. My favorite scene in the movie Robots is the domino scene and also the transport scene. Mm-hmm. It's so good. I love how mechanisms work together to create a system. And is also extremely anti-capitalist. Anyway, continue.
Wonderful. Very good. The other thing I was going to say is if you like unearthly trains,
yes.
We have talked a bit about role-playing stuff. There is a role-playing podcast series called Friends at the Table.
Oh, hell yeah.
Which I've listened to most of. Mm-hmm. It is very good. It has a lot of feelings. They do not play Dungeons & Dragons. They mostly play variations on Powered by the Apocalypse games.
Oh, hell yeah.
And one of the series in which they don't play a Powered by the Apocalypse game is called Sangfiel.
Mm.
So Sangfiel is a series of them playing a game called The Heart, which is a sort of eldritch horror system.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very strange eldritch horror. And they create... They start by doing a collaborative world-building session, and the world they come up with, which is Sangfiel,
yeah.
is this sort of like Wild West with knights in armor, but also trains are demons.
Oh.
So you can travel on trains, but it's incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, man.
And there are also these people called Shape Knights
oh.
who fight and kill trains because trains are so dangerous.
Yeah. Well, yeah, industry, man.
Yeah, it's fascinating and very weird.
I'm gonna look that up when I go home.
Finally,
yes,
people should check your stuff out because yes. you are a published poet.
Yes.
Published in some fairly exciting places. Where can people find your stuff and also just like follow you on the internet?
Yeah. Well, you can ultimately find my stuff through my Instagram. I have an Instagram page. At always by the river under the name Maori by the river. It's where I put most of my stuff out when it comes out.
To put in a pitch for that.
Yep.
Following Fire is a glorious addition to your Instagram diet because
Aww.
Mainly what you post is like poems as like screens of text
yeah.
or just kind of like atmospheric photos of the world
oh,
as
yeah.
it passes by. And so as like as an interruption to what Instagram is like.
Yeah,
it's just this gorgeous little moment of like, here is a picture of a field and a street with a streetlight that looks kind of weird.
Yeah,
and
man.
Then there's a screen that's a poem.
Yeah. It's basically
that's,
that.
That's nice. It's really good.
I'm glad. I'm really glad. I need to start keep posting there more. But no, I post there. You can find my poetry in Landfall, specifically 249 and 250. You can also find it online at Starling and at Bloodbath Journal and Nine Lives Poetry and also at Orongoho Best New Zealand Poems because I was very lucky to be included in that. Go look at it.
Yeah,
go
it's look at really it. Good. You should check it out.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatū People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatū. The show was produced and edited by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this episode, why not share it with a friend? You can find past episodes at npr.nz/show/reserved or wherever fine pods are cast. You can find me on Blue Sky at Objective Reality, and you can follow the show on Instagram and Facebook.